From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Disney has closed its $71 billion deal for most of Fox. How will the merger change Hollywood? Then actor Rob Nagel on playing Oscar Wilde on stage in The Judas Kiss about the playwright's relationship with men.
For me, forgiveness was at the core. And even The Judas Kiss, maybe a mark of betrayal, was something that, well, look, the point is to forgive. And in forgiveness, we find redemption. So I think that's what I keep going back to.
And R&B singer Emily King rediscovers her love of music by leaving the big city for a small town. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll begin today with the end of an era. This is, or was, the theme for 20th Century Fox Studios, but as of midnight Eastern Time last night, the studio is now part of Hollywood history. The Walt Disney Company's acquisition of the bulk of Fox's entertainment assets is now a done deal, a $71.3 billion deal, to be exact. Disney already bought Pixar, Lucasfilm, and Marvel, and now it has acquired what were previously Fox-owned Marvel properties, like Deadpool and X-Men, as well as the FX networks, Fox's TV production arm, and Fox's 30% stake in the streaming service Hulu. The Murdoch family will still own Fox News, the Fox Broadcasting Network, the national Fox Sports channels, and the Fox studio lot in Century City. Earlier today, I spoke with Wall Street Journal media and entertainment reporter Joe Flint about the significance of this massive Fox-Disney merger.
On the one hand, of course, it is the end of an era for Fox, for the movie studio, for the television studio, for an iconic brand that will now be part of the Walt Disney Company. And although there'll still be a Fox broadcast network and they'll still own some channels and Fox News, that whole media empire that Rupert Murdoch had acquired when it was a much smaller asset and turned it into a worldwide behemoth is over now. And conversely for Disney, they have now shrunk the number of studios, added a ton of content to their library and cable arsenal, all in the hopes of being able to better challenge Netflix and other streaming services.
So let's talk a little bit about what Bob Iger, as the head of Disney, has done in the past. He spent more than $15 billion on other deals to purchase Pixar Animation Studios, Marvel Entertainment, and Lucasfilm. And those companies now are kind of silos within Disney. They create their content. They do what they're doing. Is that going to be the model for Fox as well and Fox Searchlight? Will they continue to operate autonomously, or is there something different that's going to happen with this deal?
I think there will be something different. All those companies you cited, it's true that they have a certain amount of autonomy, but one could argue they also make a lot of content that fits into the Disney brand or what the Disney brand wants to be. And you look at a Fox Searchlight and you look at, particularly on the TV side, you look at an FX and the sort of cutting edge, darker programming they do. And you have to wonder, will Disney fully embrace these brands as well? Maybe they will. They've certainly, Fox Searchlight and FX have shown there's a market for their programming, but it certainly isn't the normal sort of Disney fare that we're accustomed to.
A lot of people have talked about the Fox assets, but there are two assets that I think are really important to this deal. One is Hulu and Fox's interest in it, and the other one is James Cameron, the filmmaker behind Avatar, who is planning at least, I think, two or three more Avatar films. So let's talk first about Hulu. How important is it that Disney is acquiring Fox's interest in Hulu as part of this deal?
Well, for Disney, now with the Fox stake in Hulu, Disney becomes the controlling shareholder. You still have Comcast with 30% and AT&T with the other 10%. But now Hulu will finally have one owner versus this partnership, which on the one hand, on the good side of the partnership was it meant that all these different Hollywood programming sources were feeding content into Hulu. The downside was when you have three three owners all owning the same amount, it just becomes hard to make sort of decisions and determine a long-term strategy. Ironically, some of the bigger issues and fights over that were between the Fox executives and the Disney executives, who will now be working together. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, most people think that Hulu will become the home of more adult-themed content that we were just talking about with Fox Searchlight and FX. But, you know, the flip side of that is, well, is Comcast going to sell their stake in Hulu? And if they do, well, all of their content might walk away with them. Or do they keep their stake? In which case, what does become of this thing? And even if Disney controls it, will it really be theirs to run without any sort of backseat driver?
And how important is Cameron to all of this? I mean, there are very few filmmakers who can make billion-dollar grossing films. James Cameron is in a company of like one, I think, at this point in his career.
Yes, Cameron is huge, and not only for the movies he makes, but the IP and the other things that can come of those movies, be it theme park rides or other, you know, other revenue streams, other ancillary possibilities for them. So he's huge. Some of the showrunners that are now going to be at Fox Disney are big. We'll see what happens. You know, it'll be interesting to watch whether a Seth MacFarlane, who does Family Guy and has, you know, made some successful movies and other TV shows, will he stick around at Disney or will he want to leave? All those things are important, because no matter, you know, we're talking about these big companies and they're assembling assets, but it still ultimately is about having the best creative talent and having a home for them where they feel they can do their best work unencumbered. And that's what Disney will have to prove to the town.
And I think we should also mention that in any consolidation like this, there are a lot of people who are going to lose their jobs. Is that one of the real consequences of a deal like this, that a lot of people will be put out of work?
Yes, and the people who will be put out of work, of course, are not the, I mean, not that some high-powered executives aren't going to be out of work. Stacy Snyder, you know, runs the Fox movie studios. You know, she'll be looking for a job, but I think she'll be fine. But all the people who just do the little things that make an operation like Fox run every day, and they have those same people at Disney. And yeah, there'll be a lot of backroom operations and a lot of consolidation, whether it's in HR, whether it's in legal, whether it's in affiliate distribution on the cable side. There will be a lot of reduction in jobs. I mean, and we're going to see it at Warner as well. I mean, just to switch gears real quick, obviously, as AT&T combines HBO and Turner and shifts assets around there, we're seeing the same sort of problems there in terms of layoffs, and people will be out of work, and it's sad.
Joe Flint covers media and entertainment at The Wall Street Journal. Joe, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a tumultuous episode from the life of Oscar Wilde as told in the play The Judas Kiss. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. KPCC is in the middle of its spring member drive, but because we met our fundraising goal this morning, we can bring you a full-length show today. Still, the drive isn't over, so why not take a moment and support The Frame and all that KPCC brings you. You could do it online at kpcc.org or call 866-888-5722. And thanks. And now, in 1895, the Irish playwright Oscar Wilde was accused of breaking the law in England. His crime? He was a gay man when homosexuality was illegal. Convicted of gross indecency, Wilde was sentenced to 2 years hard labor. The trial and its personal and professional aftermath are at the center of the play The Judas Kiss, written by David Hare. It's now playing at the Boston Court Theater in Pasadena. Rob Nagel plays Wilde, and Colin Bates co-stars as Lord Alfred Douglas, also known as Bosey, who was one of Wilde's lovers. It was actually Bosey's father, the Marquis of Queensberry, who was Wilde's adversary in court. Rob Nagel visited The Frame, and he performed part of the play in our studio.
The simple fact is, I'm cast in a role. My story has already been written. How I choose to play it is a mere matter of taste. The performance of the actor will not determine the action. The action is, I am being expelled. It's true, I am trapped in the narrative. The narrative now has a life of its own. It travels inexorably towards my disgrace, towards my final expulsion, and it bears me along on its crest.
Nagel was joined in studio by the play's director, Michael Michetti, And McKetty started by talking about how the play's relevance might have changed since its debut in 1998.
I think it's aged really well for me. In the first place, there are things about the play that I understand better now than I did when I first read it 20 years ago. And whether or not it's the right time, it is the time we are doing it. And I do think it speaks to our moment. It's a pretty personal play about love, which is universal and timeless and for every time. But it's also a play specifically about someone who is dealing with being othered in the world, who is criticized by society, who tries to get approval from society, and the society ends up vilifying him. And I think that's something that we see reflected in a lot of ways in our world.
Oscar Wilde was marginalized because he was a gay man. And yep. He was a gay man when it was against the law to be a gay man. And David Harris' play is set in two different periods in his life. Why do those two time perspectives work dramatically in terms of the periods that David Harris is focusing on in Oscar Wilde's life?
It's interesting when you look at Oscar Wilde's life, when you read the trial transcripts, when you read his letters, everyone wonders why it was he stuck with Bosie, why he was so devoted to him for so long. Even in Oscar's writing, he says, you know, my problem was not that I didn't part from you, but that I parted from you too often, and essentially that he kept coming back to him. And so historians and lovers of literature look at Oscar Wilde's life and wonder why it was he remained so devoted to Bosie. And I think that what David Harris is trying to do is to answer that dramatically. And so it's these two moments where Oscar is faced with a decision to make, and he is being pulled different directions, and he ends up making some choices without giving things away, but that reflect his devotion for Bosie and his loyalty to him. And I think David Hare has taken these two moments in Oscar's life to try to dramatize that.
Rob, when you're thinking about that relationship between Oscar Wilde and Alfred Douglas, the play is called The Judas Kiss, which certainly suggests betrayal. Mm-hmm. But the story of their relationship is really about loyalty and the tests of loyalty. When you're thinking about their relationship, because a lot of people have really wrestled with what they saw in each other and whether or not one betrayed the other, how do you approach it as the character? Because you have to believe, as an actor, that Oscar Wilde has some special bond with this person.
For sure.
How did you approach it?
Well, I think that I borrow from the Christ figure itself, that I don't think that forgiveness was something that Jesus seemed to have a hard time with. In fact, he was quite good at it from what my upbringing was about, from my Sunday schooling back when I did it. And so for me, forgiveness was the essence, and that's the essence of unconditional love. It's why parents are so good at forgiving their children for their flaws in ways that we're not so good at forgiving our parents. So for me, forgiveness was at the core. And even the Judas kiss, maybe a mark of betrayal, was something that, well, look, the point is to forgive. And in forgiveness, we find redemption. So I think that's what I keep going back to.
When you and Michael are talking about your approach to this play, what were the most meaningful conversations you had about staging this, specifically in terms of understanding where Oscar was emotionally, psychically, at this period in his life?
Well, as Rob said, one of the things we continued to explore was to find the moments where you understand what in its best time the love between Oscar and Bosie was. And it's really tricky because we see them in fraught moments, in moments of a lot of conflict and tension. But it was important for us to lay in those moments where we see, that's where that spark was. Even now in the middle of all this, we still see the affection between them. We understand what it was. We see what the appeal was. And doing so without trying to soft pedal Bosie. Bosie was, by all accounts, a volatile, difficult, really problematic young man. But there clearly had to be something about him that was also compelling and dynamic and that Oscar was attracted to.
We're talking with Rob Nagel, who plays Oscar Wilde in The Judas Kiss, and Michael McKetty, who directs the play at the Boston Court Theater. Oscar Wilde's relationship with men was not totally platonic. It was sexual.
Absolutely.
And in your staging of the play, there's no sex, but there is certainly some romance. How important was it for you as the director to not shy away from the fact that these were men in love with each other?
Yeah, I mean, it's critical, although very honestly, the characters themselves have conflicts with it. There's an interesting thing in the second act of the play. Bozzi makes arguments that Oscar had let himself and other gay men, essentially, without using the word gay, because that was not a term that was used in that period in the same way, but by not being true to himself. And Bozzi has a sort of perspective about another time in which this kind of love is accepted, and that those people will look back on Oscar and be disappointed that he failed his own people in such a way. So the play has this tension between a sort of freedom about sexuality and embracing of it and honesty about it, all of that, and also the realities of, in that time, what that meant, what the kind of danger that it put you in, the sort of pressures from society. Oscar was imprisoned at hard labor for 2 years over this. So it was a very complicated time. And in a time, very honestly, where the idea of homosexual behavior as a identity rather than a behavior was pretty foreign at that time.
But even though this story happens a long time ago, it's fair to say that there are still issues that we are wrestling with. Marriage equality is under attack. And it's not just that these are two men in love. There's a big age difference, too, between Oscar Wilde and Bozzi or Alfred Douglas. And it seems to be that I think audiences looking at this couple, and maybe you see this from the audience itself, has their own judgments about them as a couple and whether or not they're together. And I'm wondering, in conversations that you have after the play, because you've done some talkbacks, what you hear from the audience about how contemporary this play feels to them and how it might challenge their own assumptions of what is and is not a proper couple.
I don't recall in any of the discussions that I've had in post shows or privately that anyone has brought up the age difference, but I know it's there.
Definitely.
It's very clear. It seems like those are conversations that we're not actually having yet, but I'd love to have them because it's very interesting. There is something there, though, the older scholar, the older writer, bringing up the younger writer. But yeah, we do have judgments of it. It's not just marriage equality, for sure, that some areas of the country are grappling with, including our own. But it's also the age difference. Like, when is it all right for you to be with a younger person? I don't have an answer, but I do fully invest in Oscar's journey, because he goes back to the movement that brought him into, you know, into his art, which was the pursuit of beauty.
And Michael, what about you? What are you hearing from audiences that make you feel the play is connecting, or at least bringing up modern issues?
What I am hearing is people who are frustrated that they want Oscar to make a different choice, that they have some kinds of judgments on the relationship, because it's clearly, it's a relationship that is fraught. There's no question, you know? And so people look at it, and I think that people see themselves in this relationship, and they are uncomfortable with the sort of loyalty and devotion that Oscar gives to Bozzi with all of this. What strikes me is that it is striking a chord with people, because the dynamics of this relationship are very familiar. We have either been in that relationship on one side or the other of it, or we've witnessed it with people who we love.
And I think, Rob, in terms of Oscar himself, it's a very fine line between being stubborn and being a martyr. And I guess people can argue about which one he was.
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on the page of the play, I suppose, is how your perspective would go. Whether he's putting himself up for downfall and disaster, or whether he's fighting for the love of his life. I do think he's fighting for the love of his life, though on the outside it sure looks like it's he's trying to sacrifice himself to a greater good.
Rob Nagel plays Oscar Wilde in The Judas Kiss. Michael Michetti directs the play at the Boston Court. It's there through March 24th. Rob and Michael, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much, John. It was a pleasure to see you.
A treat.
The Judas Kiss is playing at the Boston Court Theater in Pasadena through March 24th. Coming up on The Frame, how a change of scenery inspired Emily King's latest album. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. R&B singer-songwriter Emily King is just 33 years old, but she's already had a long career. She released her first album, East Side Story, in 2007. Though it earned her a Grammy nomination for Best Contemporary R&B Album, she was later dropped by her label because of poor sales. King has since released 3 acclaimed albums, largely on her own volition, with the help of producer and songwriting partner Jeremy Most. King's parents, Marion Cowings and Kim Colesti, are both well-respected jazz singers, and their home was always filled with music. but King's entire life had been spent in New York City. So for her latest album, Scenery, she was inspired to pick up and move to a small town in upstate New York.
Do I have to explain that I care for somebody in love?
Hey, my name is Emily King. I'm a musician and songwriter from New York City. I think I don't even realize how much musically I've been influenced by the city. I mean, you have no choice but to hear what everybody's thinking. You know, they'll let you know what they're thinking. There's been multiple occasions where I just pass by somebody and they'll say something. And it's like, that's a song, you know, that's just what I needed. Thanks. No publishing, but I appreciate it. I think I'm just like really trying to force myself now to purposefully breathe and be so, like, there's a song on my record called Second Guess, and it's very rhythmic, but if you don't breathe in between the phrase, like, you can't sing the next phrase. So it's like, I'll be the one to love you when there's no one else around. Be the one to hold you when the others let you down. I know it sounds crazy, I know we just met. You know, and if you don't get that breath in, then the song, the rest of the song is sacrificed. So now when I practice, I just practice breathing. Because I have in the past let my nerves get to me where I forget to breathe. Because that's the first thing that goes when you're nervous.
No regrets. Oh, why not take chances? Oh, why can we let these hearts go?
Yeah, so growing up, my parents, they used to sing together. And so it was like a lot of bebop, and they do like cruise ships and the Blue Notes and all that kind of stuff. And I just kind of like peripherally got to hear all that stuff when I was a kid, like Al Foster and Kenny Barron and Steve Gomez and all these amazing musicians. Both of my parents have always been really adamant about telling the story. You know, we'll see somebody perform and they'll be like, she sounded great, but she didn't even think about what she was singing. You know, so if you're singing a sad song with like up-tempo swing, it's like something, there's a disconnect here.
Are you hearing about me? How you dealing without me? Hello.
Look at me now. I had that intro. Are you hearing about me? For like years. And then I actually woke up and I had dreamt this like melody, like, and then later that night I played it for Jeremy and he was like, no, it should be this. Look at me now. And I was like, that's so swaggy, I love it.
Did you hear about me?
And then I thought, wait, can I go there? Because I don't want to come across as like that kind of person, you know?
Did you hear about me? You pushed me around, but now I'm pushing people, baby, look at me now.
But it was just so much fun. And some of my favorite music is like attitude driven.
Did you hear about me? You thought I could bend. You thought I hurt me, but you'll never do it again.
I really wanted to, because I love classic rock and I love R&B, and so I thought that the person who did it the best is Tina Turner. Like, it made it to mainstream, but it also, she had so much soul. So I was like, let's try.
What's love got to do? It's got to do with it.
At one point during this album process, I was getting so heady about songwriting. And I just wanted to write the perfect song, and how do I do that? And let me listen to the songs I think are great. And I got with my buddy, Shervin Lanez, who took my last two album covers. And he said something along the lines of, I don't want you to write a perfect song. I want to know how you feel. And I was like, now I have to get in touch with my feelings? That's the last thing I want to do. But it really struck a chord with me, because I thought, I know all the great songs were from a feeling, but how do I get in touch with my feelings? Because at the time I was feeling really bored just with my existence because I was living with my mom. And so that's when I knew I gotta make a change. This is gonna be stressful. And I moved upstate and I learned how to drive, and that triggered a feeling inside of me.
Been without it for so long, forgot what it feels like.
I started singing this melody and it turned into Remind Me, and it really was just a feeling. But I had to go through all of this other stuff to make it happen for myself. Because it wasn't just happening. I often do that where I just kind of wait for things to happen to me. But this was the one time where I just took action and said, let's try something different. And so I think that worked out.
Something else, something that I used to feel, something like what I've been missing.
That segment was produced by The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett and Paul Ratliff. And that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.